This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, writing sex scenes. It's not as hard as you think. Right, well, this one's probably been developing for a while, shall we say. And there is a particular aspect of sex in fantasy and science fiction novels which probably needs to be looked at separately, but what we're going to do is look at sex scenes in general and what sort of function they serve in a narrative arc, and having got that basis down, we'll go from there.
We are mature adults looking at this in a mature way. So, I think it's fair to say that sex does appear a lot in fiction. This is probably because sex appears a lot in real life too. So we can't really be surprised by its presence in our books and our media. Obviously, as sex has become more accepted and, you know, we've become less restrained about it, we started to see more of it, more of its presence in fiction. Not to say that it wasn't there before. I mean, we've got fine examples, Lady Chatterley's Lover, etc., of slightly older books that did have some rather explicit sex scenes in them. But we're definitely seeing a lot more of them now. And with that, we get all sorts of different kind of sex scenes. We get the good, the bad, and the ugly, I think is the best way to describe them. So which shall we start out with?
Well, let's start with the fact, let's look at sex and violence. And by sex and violence, I don't mean rape. What I mean is a sex scene serves the same function in a narrative arc as a scene of violence or a fight scene does, which means if it doesn't move the narrative arc along and it doesn't enhance the character journey, it shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And that's not me being prudish. That's just a case of, well, you're wasting a scene with something that's not really important.
Yeah. You've got to ask then at one point whether the sex scene there is... Well, I mean, we say it's not important, but I mean, sometimes sex scenes are literally just in there for the fan service, to be honest.
Yeah, it's titillation value. Yeah. I mean, okay, if we were to take Outlander as an example, which is, you know, just about speculative fiction because of the time travel element.
Yeah, that's a pretty speculative thing.
Yeah, it's a relatively racy read in some respects, but when you really break down the sex scenes and look at them properly, it's not just porn. It's clearly serving a function within the narrative. And whether you find it all a bit sort of like over romanticized and unlikely or whatever, you know, that's fine. But it is showing that there's really strong attraction, so that there is a reason for her to want to stay 200 years in the past away from her husband. In a place where, you know, people still die of smallpox and she could get, you know, burned as a witch. So,
yeah,
it's part of showing that function, because she doesn't talk about, you know, love until much, much later on in the book. It's 2/3 of the way through that the sex most definitely comes first, but it does show the attraction and the compatibility.
Yeah.
And rather horribly, it shows a comparison between, you know, Jamie, who becomes her second husband in the past, and Frank, who's her first husband, and the fact that, you know, while everything's okay with Frank and it's all good now, somehow it's just better with somebody else. The compatibility maybe is higher or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, it's a way of foreshadowing this decision to stay in the past.
Yeah. And it also, I mean, bearing in mind again, and we'll talk a little bit more about sex and historical fiction in general. When we consider how we assumed sex was for people within the past, I mean, we have a very restrained kind of image of how people interacted with sex in the past, particularly women. Obviously, women couldn't really be having sex for enjoyment because there was the high risk of getting pregnant, which could destroy you socially. So we have this image that in the past, sex was something that was really only enjoyed by men, and that it wasn't something that women did outside of marriage, and it wasn't something that they necessarily enjoyed. And of course, this is naive, because it's not just that in the last sort of few years women have suddenly developed the capacity to enjoy sex. You know, there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of evidence pre the kind of the big social movement that said that we shouldn't be enjoying sex. People did, both men and women, and pretty much, you know, just people enjoyed sex. And so actually, when you get historical fiction with sex scenes in it, it's also telling you something about the woman within that. Because regardless of, you know, Outlander, it is still historical fiction. Even though she went back into the past, the place she was also originally from is history to us.
Yeah.
You know? So she is a woman out of time who's also out of our time. But she's a very, she's in charge very much of her own sexuality. And that is meant to tell us something about her. She is modern, basically. She's not restrained by these things. She's a modern woman. And so yeah. In that way, the sex is used to show that element, whether or not it's biased, whether or not it's something that needs to be addressed. That's what that technique is kind of used for. And very often you'll see it. You'll see that the modern woman character, a woman who has her own, you know, agenda, who has, you know, her own power, is usually quite sexually explicit as well.
Yeah, there is quite a lot of, even in novels...
In fiction, I should add, by the way.
In fiction, it's certainly presented that way. I mean, even if you think about something like, and this is not speculative at all, but something like Pride and Prejudice or Mansfield Park,
yeah.
Whereby you have two, in each one, you have one female character who sort of bucks the norms. But Lydia in Pride and Prejudice, who goes off with Wickham.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, she was taken advantage of, and perhaps she was to a certain extent. But at the same time, you could look at it from another perspective whereby, you know what, she sort of does know about the birds and the bees. They weren't kept in ignorance. That was something that happened in the Victorian era.
Yeah.
So she does sort of know what's going on. She's done something a bit thoughtless and very stupid, but by our standards, it wouldn't be considered that bad.
No.
And then in Mansfield Park, you've got the elder of the two sisters who leaves her fiancé and basically ruins herself. And it is a reflection of the times, but at the same time, it's also, well, she's kind of taken charge of her own sexuality. She's made a stupid mistake and she's chosen the wrong person, but...
Yeah.
Again, it's showing you something about the character, as you say. And it really is sort of the whole sexual repression thing really sort of came in with the Victorian era.
Yeah. But because it came with the Victorian era, and something strange happened in the Victorian era, which is the Victorian era, and, you know, we've mentioned it before, because of the Industrial Revolution, they started grappling at the past a little bit. They got quite obsessed with the past. And I think in many ways the Victorian era put their values onto the past, which means that we, coming out of the Victorian era, kind of imagine that the past, all of the past, was a little bit like the Victorian era, that all of the past had the same kind of morals, because that was kind of what we were taught, because the Victorians didn't want to think of an unsophisticated past. They took elements of the past that they wanted, and then they applied their own kind of rules to it, and then that's what... So we don't have this idea of, I mean, the fact that there were same-sex marriages within the Catholic Church in England was a thing that did actually happen. I mean, that was just stomped out. You know, things that didn't fit in with the Victorian narrative were stomped out very much during that period. I mean, that happens throughout history. But in particular, I think sex and human interaction with sex was our idea of human interaction with sex in the past was very much shaped by the Victorian period.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And unfortunately, that was a mindset that carried on over into the early 20th century and up until sort of the Second World War, because mm-hmm. after that particular war, or during it, people came to sort of a conclusion that, you know, while single, unwed mothers weren't necessarily a benefit, at the same time it wasn't considered perhaps as bad as it was before. Things had started to relax a bit. It got to the point where people cared less about who was hopping into bed with who because the war was so terrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a Second World War after a really awful first one as well, so
yeah. But, you know, previous to that you had women who would sleep with their sweethearts before they went off to war, because they didn't know if they were ever going to see them again.
No.
But you also had men sort of probably pressuring women a little bit, saying, well, you know, I could die. And you can kind of understand men not wanting to be virgins. And I saw, this is a little bit unrelated, but I saw this fantastic film, and I'm pretty sure it had Dame Judi Dench in it, about this woman who opens this theatre where she just gets naked women on the stage. And they have to hold still as statues, because if they're moving, then it's pornographic. But if they're still, then it's art.
Yeah, and funnily enough, my friend's mum, who I think is in her 70s now, or late 70s. This was still going on when she lived in London, and she said as an 18-year-old she went and saw this happening.
Yeah, and the idea about the film is that you find out that this woman who opened this sort of theatre and started getting it going said that, well, it was because my son died in the war. And when I was going through his affairs, I found a picture of a naked woman. And she realised that that was the only that he never saw a naked woman. He died never seeing a naked woman, yeah, other than that picture. And so she started this thing so that people had a chance to actually to do that before they went off and died, and that women had a chance to experience. Because obviously, you know, none of these women were forced to do it. They all came and they did it by choice. They all, you know. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. And then, yeah, I think after the post-war, everyone kind of went back to their roots a little bit and suddenly went, actually, why can't we enjoy this? Why are we not allowed to enjoy this? Yeah. And I think there was an element of, well, which is that I think that after the war, people's relationship with religion changed. And I think religion has shaped sex quite a lot. And we'll talk about that again in a second. But I think people's relationship with the church and with God changed after this terrible, terrible war. And they stopped kind of feeling quite so guilty about sex. And interestingly enough, that is again something you see, especially in historical fiction, where you see the women who are having sex, who are enjoying sex, the people who are enjoying sex, are kind of considered to be heathens.
Yeah.
Or there's often a relationship between witchcraft and hot, steamy sex. One thing that comes to mind is both, again, we've mentioned Camelot, but also Penny Dreadful.
Yeah.
You've got Vanessa Ives, who is obviously very much in charge of her own sort of sexuality and enjoys having the very hot, steamy sex. And again, the same actress, Eva Green, playing Morgan in Camelot. Same thing, using sex, but there's that connection with witchcraft. There's that connection with the power surge, with the devil, with things like that.
Yeah, and that was actually, you know, whether someone was accusing someone else of witchcraft, at least over here, it was very much a case of, oh, well, I saw her doing this. She soured the milk. She turned the baby in that one's womb, and I saw her definitely copulating with the devil, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was sort of, I don't know how much it was thrown on just as an extra, but it certainly came up a lot.
Yeah. It's funny that the devil was never named. I saw her copulating with the devil. No, it was just Steve. Ah, shush.
I mean, some of that obviously would be to do with some of the old pagan rites where you'd have the man wearing the horns of the stag, but that's a bit of a tangent, so we won't go down that one. Another interesting aspect is the fact that there doesn't have to be any sex in a sex scene for it to be a sex scene.
Give an example.
Okay, something like, there's I can't remember the name of the book now, but it's by Dorothy L. Sayers, and she's talking about the main character who is looking at a bloke she finds really attractive, and this is sort of in the 1940s, 1950s. And what she's looking at really oddly is that sort of small semicircle of skin behind the ear where the hair's like cropped back, and it's described in such exquisite detail. And then it ends with something like, and when she looked away, she was as hot as if she'd been dipped into boiling water. And honestly, the way it's described, it's like, well, no, actually, that is a sex scene.
Do you and the ear need a room?
But, you know, that sort of getting across that idea of attraction and, you know, a feeling of sexual awareness in yourself without necessarily saying as much in so many words, that's still a sex scene. And it's like a lot of kissing scenes are also sex scenes, or scenes where there is a lot of emotional intimacy. Potentially, they're sex scenes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing that comes to mind is that people complain about some of the Jane Austen books and some of the Jane Austen adaptations because they say, oh, well, you know, now in this day and age, it's so tame, you know, they just need to have a good old snog and stuff like that. I'm like, are you not watching the dance scenes?
Yeah, that's what that was all about. That was an excuse to touch in public.
Yeah, to touch in public, and it's not just to touch in public. They're doing something which requires physical exertion, okay?
Yeah.
They're getting close, they're moving together, they're touching. It's very concentrated. And they're doing something which gets them both flustered. I mean, usually up until this point, you know, sports were pretty much separated, you know, unless you were very rich, you might play, you know, court tennis. But, you know, it was usually women did sports together, men did sports together. This was something where people are exerting themselves and they're mingling. Dancers were very important in that respect. And particularly it's no longer the new Pride and Prejudice, but the Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden, there was a lot of tension throughout. I mean, they actually managed to do that. They managed to get that kind of that physical tension between them quite well. The BBC adaptation obviously also did have that that kind of tension, but in particular the new one, they were really trying to get that sexual tension across, and I think they did. There were moments of great intimacy, which were more intimate than if we'd seen them having sex.
Yeah, I mean, you get that with some of the Victorian novels as well, so things like Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
I remember reading it at 13 and I wouldn't have picked up on it in the same way, and then sort of reading it again in my 20s, I was like, well, actually that is something really quite physical there, even though they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
And thinking, you know, that's hot stuff for the Victorian era. That's why Charlotte Bronte was called coarse and she couldn't possibly be a proper woman. And you got the same thing, obviously, with Wuthering Heights, which probably has even more of a sexual undertone because of the violence.
Yeah.
And even The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, which is by Anne Bronte, which, you know, has suggestions of you know, real sexual attraction, then bad sex, and then, you know, full-on rape.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, not to confuse, obviously, sex and rape, because rape is actually a fight scene or a violence scene.
Yeah, it's an act of violence. It's not actually an act of sex. A sexual act for the most part. It's a thing of dominance, and we've got an episode about that, so we're not going to go into that.
The thing, if you want to be able to write a convincing sex scene, is first of all to bear in mind you don't have to put any sex in it.
And there are some sex scenes that have all the sex in them, but which I would just describe as crude rather than sex scenes.
Yeah, that is the problem, obviously, when you write sex scenes, is you have to get the balance right. On one hand, metaphor is really, really not your friend. So it can be too much crashing waves and molten rock and things like that. And on the other hand, it can sound too much like plumbing if you're just going to describe physical detail.
Yeah, it's about finding that nice kind of balance between the two, which doesn't make it too cheesy, because at the end of the day, like, sex is very hard to write because it's an incredibly repetitive act.
Yeah, there's only so many ways you can, which is where obviously, in the same way with a fight scene, the emotional content has to come into it, otherwise it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got some examples of stuff not to do.
Fantastic. All right, I'm looking forward to this. Okay.
They're largely not speculative. This is people writing literary fiction and not quite getting the sex right. This one's from The Butcher's Hook by Janet Ellis.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
A sort of medieval. Okay. Anne, he says, stopping and looking down at me. I am pinned like wet washing with his peg. Till now, I thought the sweetest sound I could ever hear was cows chewing grass, but this is better. He sways and we listen to the soft suck at the exact place where we meet. Then I move and put all thoughts of livestock out of his head. It's pretty cringeworthy stuff.
Okay, well,
the minute she says I was pinned like wet washing, you've lost me completely. And obviously you have to be fair, these things are quoted out of context.
Unless you're writing a particular, very niche kind of story, rule of thumb is don't bring livestock into a sex scene.
That would be very niche.
I'm sure there's stuff out there, and kudos to you, but generally, no, don't do that.
Okay, try this next one.
Okay.
This is from A Doubter's Almanac by Ethan Kanan. The act itself was fervent, like a brisk tennis game on a summer track meet. Something performed in daylight between competitors.
No.
The metaphor doesn't work for me. The idea of them being competitors does suggest something very particular about it, in the sense of this is not something they're engaged in together. This is kind of something they're trying to do against each other. So that almost works, but the rest of it?
Well, I think either the person writing it has got a very strong relationship with tennis, you know, with the sports. Because, you know, that being said, I've seen scenes from, like, sports anime. That's going to sound so odd. But, you know, you're on Tumblr, you see things. I've seen scenes from sports anime, and sometimes the way that they do the sports is verging on sexual. There's a series at the moment which is causing a lot of noise, and I won't talk about this too much, but it's causing a lot of noise. It's called Yuri on Ice,
right.
And it's about ice skating. And it's very sexual. They're doing these amazing performances on the ice, and that they're narrating the stories of you know what their dance is about. And dancing, you know, as we've established, can be a very sexual thing to do. Even if you've got all your clothes on, it's a very expressive thing. So they're doing these amazing dances, and the thing is that one of them. Is his dance, his whole theme is eros, the sort of sexual love. And so his dance is very sexual without actually, you know, being sexually explicit. But the way the movements they do, things like that, it is basically like watching a sex scene in some of these.
Yeah.
So I feel like sport can in some ways be, you know, physical sports where you're putting a lot into it can in some ways be coupled with sex, but I don't think sex can be coupled with sport in the same way.
It was the simile, I think, wasn't it? It just doesn't quite.
Yeah, brisk. It did say brisk, didn't it? Did I imagine that?
Fervent. Like a brisk tennis game, yes.
Yeah, that brisk has a coldness to it as well. Yeah. Oh, it's a little bit brisk. Like... Just imagine two straight-faced people playing tennis and looking sort of a little bit, you know. That doesn't equate to sex, at least not, you know, good sex anyway.
No, of course, I haven't actually read this book, but obviously if it was a case of him wanting to portray a bad sex scene, then, you know, well done, you've done it. I still don't think it quite works for me, but... Okay, try this one. This is from the same book. When she was sufficiently aroused, a hush would finally settle, and then, with a sigh, she would roll over gently onto her back, like a doe turning in leaves.
Again, with the livestock. I guess it's not livestock, but just, again, with the animal imagery. I guess that one isn't too bad, if that's the only thing. Again, it depends on the story, doesn't it? It depends on the imagery that you've used around it. If this was kind of like a sort of... a fairy forest dwelling forest dwelling kind of story about sort of half human creatures, then maybe it could sort of be gotten away with as art. But if that's from the same book,
yeah, that's pretty cringeworthy. It's the whole sort of, you know, a hush would settle and then it sounded like she'd grudgingly roll onto her back and let him get on with it.
She's there like, oh, all right. Yeah, it kind of does sound a little bit like, well, I guess I'm at a point where this won't hurt me, so I just go on, get on with it.
I mean, the final nail in the coffin there is likening her to a deer and saying she was rolling in some leaves. Just like, no, that doesn't work. Okay, this one's interesting. This is Here I Am by Jonathan Safran Foer. Once he'd trained his sphincter to stop reflexively impersonating a Chinese finger trap, it felt pretty good.
What? That sounds like something you'd say in a conversation if you were...
really crude?
Yeah, if you're being crude among very crude friends, it sounds like someone's like, well, once he'd, you know, stop, you know, squeezing me like he was trying to kill me, it was okay. You know, that like that sound that, but as a piece of description in a book,
yeah. These are literary novels as well, remember that.
Oh dear.
This is another one. Okay, this is from Men Like Air by Tom Connolly. He watched her passport rise gradually out of the back pocket of her jeans in time with the rhythmic bobbing of her buttocks as she sucked him.
Well, I guess in some ways, actually, I have more respect for that one than I do for the others. Because it kind of does highlight the silliness of sex.
Yes.
Sex looks incredibly silly, if you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, real sex, you know, pornographic sex isn't really what sex looks like or sounds like or, you know, is like at all. Sex is actually pretty hilarious if you think about it. It looks very silly. Silly things happen. You end up smacking heads, you know, all sorts of stuff happens that is just definitely one wouldn't consider romantic. So I guess the kind of, I can sort of appreciate that element, you know, the silly element in that, if, you know, in real. It's definitely not romantic, but then I wonder whether it's meant to be romantic.
I think that one is supposed to be an example of bad sex. It's kind of like, well, I'm getting on with it, and, you know, I'm noticing things like the fact her passport's about to come out of her pocket. I mean, clearly it's a quickie somewhere.
Yeah, this is not something that is engaging him fully mentally and physically. It's just the physical side. He's concentrating. He's noticing the passport. He's not noticing what she's doing. And I think that actually brings us quite well onto our onto bad sex.
Yeah, here's a good one for that. Okay. This is the butcher's hook again, so the one I read at the beginning.
Hooray.
We breathe heavily, breached, adjusting to air. There is a fish smell too, as if the tide has just gone out.
Go to a doctor.
Yes.
Please go to a doctor.
Please go to a doctor and don't let us read this.
Something is not quite right.
Oh, here's another one with livestock.
Okay.
During sex, she would quiet, moving suddenly on top of him like a lion over its prey. Her eyes stayed wide. Andret liked to keep his own closed, but whenever he opened them, there she would be, staring down at him, her black pupils gyroscopically inert. That just sounds really creepy.
It sounds terrifying. I'm not surprised he keeps his eyes closed if every time he looks up, she's just leering down at him. That's mildly terrifying.
Yeah, that was a doubter's almanac again. So that's not great. Oh, here's another classic from the butcher's hook.
Okay.
His finger is inside me, his thumb circling, and I spill like grain from a bucket. Really big on farming in this one.
Clearly, I mean, I presume that, well, you know, by the title, I presume farming is a thing, isn't
it's
it?
It's a sort of, it's a bodice ripper historical crime type thing.
Got it.
Yeah.
I think the real crime here is... No, I'm not going to say that.
So, anyway, there's more, but really that's a pretty good sampling of some really, you know, bad metaphors that perhaps you shouldn't use.
Yeah.
So leave animals out of it. Leave grain out of it is probably a good idea as well, and fish.
Yeah.
Leave food out unless food is actually present.
Yeah, it's about finding that balance. It's finding the balance between... I tend to find that if you're going to use metaphor in sex, the metaphor should really be about the emotion. You can use metaphor for the emotion rather than the physical act. Because the moment you apply metaphors for the physical act is the moment it becomes comedic in a way that you probably don't intend it to be comedic.
Yeah, it basically turns into slapstick.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you don't need to describe every single last little millimetre of detail either.
No. So, you know, spending more time focusing on the emotional aspect. And again, using metaphor to describe that. I mean, I think it's a little bit cheesetastic, and, you know, we'll go a little bit more into YA sex scenes. But I think, because it's the most recent one that I've read, some of the sex scenes you get in a lot of Sarah J. Maas's stories.
Yeah. So you're not thinking of the one I am where it's a throne of glass one. She bursts into flames literally during... literally burst into flames.
I wasn't thinking of that, though. Maybe that's what I'll do to Rufus. No, I'm not going to do that.
Don't you dare.
No, but no, I'm thinking, I haven't read A Throne of Glass, but I'm thinking A Court of Fist and Fury.
Yeah, that was a bit racier than I was expecting. But in all fairness, it is billed as new adult, isn't it? Which is a bit of a wishy-washy term for it's young adult, but I want to put more sex into it.
Yeah, so it's young adult, but the higher end of young adult. So, and you know, it is very racy, and she's not shy about describing what's happening. But most of the metaphors she does use are with regards to the kind of the emotional build-up rather than the physical one, which means that actually it doesn't feel too cringeworthy. It's cringeworthy in the way that it's young adult sex in some ways, and so it's very sort of, and we were inseparable, we were the light and darkness conjoined together.
We could take the universe apart and put it back together.
Yeah, kind of thing, which that's fair enough, but that, you know, that's the story. That's not actually anything to do with the bad writing of a sex scene. That's just the general kind of element of the story. It's that kind of romance, you know.
Yeah.
So I actually felt that those sex scenes were actually well done, because they were racy, but they were relatively tasteful. I say tasteful. You know what I mean.
Yes, as tasteful as these things ever are.
Yeah. And who are we kidding? I definitely enjoyed every single one of them. Oh, recent. Well, anyway. See,
that's the funny thing about sex. I mean, people... We're really, really curious about it with everybody else as well. And, you know, there are people who quite enjoy just watching it. Otherwise, there wouldn't be such a thriving porn industry.
Yeah.
And reading about it, hearing about how other people have done it, as if something's really going to change, you know?
Yeah.
And it's pretty much stayed the same for the last, 40, 50, 60,000 years.
I think as we become more unrepressed about, you know, as we start to accept it a little bit more... Our curiosity is actually, I think, very much stemmed by this repression, which has still kind of lingered from the Victorian period, basically.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of A Court of Mist and Fury, I'd like to talk about bad sex in books. Now, at the beginning of the book, again, apologies, you know, spoilers for anyone who hasn't read it yet, you've got Feyre and Tamlin having sex. And it's not good sex. As in, the sex itself seems to be good, but the emotional aspect of the sex is not good. And we can kind of see that as readers. They're using sex to kind of silence each other and to fill the space.
Yeah, I mean, the sex very much highlights the fact that they're not connecting on an emotional level.
Yeah.
And they're not speaking to each other properly about the things that are actually important, so...
Yeah. I mean, at one point... Feyre is actually trying to talk to Tamlin about Lucien, which it was very odd because he turns around and he says, I don't want to hear you talking about another man whilst we're having sex. And I thought, that's a fair enough thing. You know, like, no, I really don't want to listen to you talking about my best friend whilst we're in the middle of something. I can kind of appreciate that. But it makes me question why, obviously, Feyre, you know, would have realised that. Feyre wouldn't have been in the mood to be thinking about Lucien. If she was really into what was happening to her physically. And then she does get into it because it kind of picks up a little bit. But the fact that she went on for so long talking about Lucien and talking about other things, again, that was the bit that set alarm bells off in my head whilst I was reading it, because I just thought, something is wrong here, because she's not engaged with the sexual act. She's not wholly looking at Tamlin. She's trying to have a conversation with him. And the sex is secondary at this point. She's not connecting with it. The sex is literally just a physical act. And yeah. That was the moment that it was kind of highlighted for me.
No, I'd agree with that. Yeah, sex in teen and young adult fiction is a bit of an interesting one, really, because it doesn't really serve the same function as it does in, say, your adult fantasy and science fiction novels,
yeah,
in my opinion. And it, you know, there's emotional content in both cases, usually, unless you're displaying the fact that they're not connecting.
Yeah.
But with teen and young adult, I wouldn't say there was an informative side to it, but it's more a case of, some of them seem more romanticized to me, to possibly to capture interest, but also to present things in a certain way.
Yeah.
And oddly, that's something Sarah J. Maas seems to do differently, is the fact that I don't think she really dresses it up that much.
No, she doesn't. And I think one thing we often forget is that, you know, we talk about the amazing sex scenes that happen in Sarah J. Maas's A Court of Thorns and Roses series. But the first person that Feyre has sex with is a guy from the village. And the way she describes it, it was good in the respect that I think it was actually a very realistic look at just... just physical sex, yeah, without the kind of the emotional side to it, which is that she enjoyed it. It was good, but it wasn't actually, you know, it wasn't love, and she didn't fool herself into thinking it was love.
Yeah, it just sort of scratched an itch, and, you know, it was a hard life kind of thing.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, the other thing was that Feyre was never really, it wasn't punished for that relationship, you know, which is good. Because very often you get a lot of YA fiction where, you know, that the girl is saving herself up for the right man, and so when they do have sex, it's wonderful and explosive and it's everything she ever dreamed. Yeah. Whereas very often, you know, sex is good, but for a lot of girls and guys, you know, just for a lot of girls and guys and every people between, sex gets better with time.
You're suggesting an element of practice is necessary.
Yeah, an element of practice. If I've read this A long time ago, I read a bunch of translated Japanese tales, romantic tales, and I cannot for the life of me remember what the title was. But they did something very accurate, which is that these two young, beautiful people saw each other and they fell madly in love, and they finally got the chance to sort of be together. And then they tried to have sex. And there's this description, which is that they got very frustrated because it was hurting and it was uncomfortable and they couldn't figure out how it was supposed to work and how what they were supposed to do, and they cried with frustration because they couldn't get it right until they managed to sort of figure it out, and then it was good after that, basically. And I think there's an element of truth to that, which is that no one goes into sex and is just amazing. You know, there is an element of practice. And I liked the fact that Feyre had sex with someone before, and it wasn't bad. It was good. It was mediocre. It was what she needed out of it. The sex with Tamlin was different again because there was an emotional aspect to it. And then sex with Recent was even better because there was an even bigger emotional aspect to it. And I liked that. I liked the reality of it, which it wasn't just telling readers that, no, she should have waited for the right match. She should have just waited for Recent and then things would have been better. It was that it didn't matter how many people she'd had sex with before. It didn't diminish the sex she had with true love later on.
Oddly enough, this is where the over-romanticising sort of goes a bit wrong, actually, I think, yeah. Is it suggests that, you know, just once with someone and then off with someone else is, you know, punishable by death kind of thing. And it's not. That shouldn't be something that's perpetuated in a young adult novel, in my opinion. Is Tamora Pierce is the will of the Empress, and you've got one of the main characters. He's a really, really nice lad, but, you know, he's an 18-year-old lad. And
yeah.
While he doesn't treat anybody badly, he doesn't really go back for seconds every time.
Yeah.
And part of it is he has been in a very, very traumatic war and doesn't really like being alone at night, but he's not in a position where he can just say, look, can you stay with me to anybody, because he's not admitting it to himself. So he goes out and, you know, doesn't have any trouble picking up willing women, some of them much older than him. And it's always, you know, perfectly honest and done respectfully and everything. But it's a case of, you know, no, I don't think we really need to see each other again, you know, the next day.
Yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with having that presented as it is either. And unfortunately, that's something that does seem to be the case, particularly with female main characters. You know, you can't, they're not allowed to, you know, it has to be a real exception if there's more than one true love kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think also when you get it with male characters who have sex casually, they're seen as kind of players, and they're often coupled with adulterers, you know?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be that case at all.
No, well, I think, you know, again, and this is something that I tried to do, which is that Rufus is obviously a very sexually active character. People might have noticed.
Yeah.
But he doesn't go around. He's very sexually active. And he goes with people. He has an understanding of the people he has sex with. And they both have fun, and then they go their separate ways.
Yeah.
But he's not an adulterer. He's not a player in that sense. He's not there wooing someone, saying, "Oh, I will be with you forever" and stuff like that. And there's this element that there's only two kinds. You can either be a prude or you can be a whore, basically. And these are the two separations. And I think actually that's something that Sarah J. Maas really did address. And another way she addresses it is obviously that Recent is literally called whore throughout the books. And that's something that actually really bothers him. And so even though that's not obviously one of the biggest main themes, it's something that Sarah J. Maas does actually address.
Yeah. As I said, obviously Tamora Pierce had been doing that as well. I mean,
yeah.
She doesn't go into quite as much detail, in fairness. Her scenes aren't very racy. It's more a case of, yes, that's what they got up to. But, I mean,
tick the box.
She was obviously writing a lot of these about 20 years earlier. So what you could get away with in a young adult novel then, when it wasn't even really considered young adult, was, you know, quite a bit lesser, as it were. It wasn't as detailed. And, you know, there has to be also, the trouble is, there are scenes where clearly there should have been a sex scene and they've just closed the doors really, really firmly on it.
Yeah.
And then you see them the next morning. And it's like, well, that's like saying, yeah, we're building up to a fight scene and it's all going to happen off stage and you're not going to see any of it. It's the same. And it feels just as false.
Exeunt, pursued by a bear.
But on the other hand, you do have to have an author who's comfortable writing it, because if you don't, you will end up with too much metaphor or plumbing, because they won't be able to walk the middle line, unfortunately. Mm. So it's a case of writing what you're comfortable with. And if you're comfortable saying, well, this is what we got up to, and, Tamora Pierce covers this quite well with one of her characters. She says, well, it's where she's writing it in a journal almost, she says, I've heard of people who write down what exactly they do with their lovers, and then other people coming along and reading it all. So I'm not going to write it down, but let's just say that my friends were right. When you're with someone who really knows what they're doing, you know, it's a completely different experience to just a bit of a roll in the hay.
And I think, it's worth reminding any, you know, listeners who are writing scenes with romance, it is possible to have the sex scene with, you don't actually have to write sex.
No.
You don't actually have to have any explicit sex in a story to do that. And you know, ways of doing that is to actually, you know, describe sort of the scene afterwards, to describe the build-up, to describe the kisses and caresses and things along those lines, or just even the conversation that kind of happens afterwards, the energy that when you're building something up, it doesn't necessarily have to end in the physical act of sex. The build-up can be all about the emotional side of things. So you can have sex behind closed doors. You can lead us to know exactly what's going to happen. But I think, okay, an example of this I've watched and that can be compared with the books is obviously the recent series of Paul Dark. He and Elizabeth finally have sex. And there was a lot of, you know, people were dreading and looking forward to the scene, I guess. I say looking forward to, you know, they were wondering how it was going to be done. Because obviously there is a it is left open in the books a little bit. We don't know whether it's actually rape or not. And, you know, they do it as sex in the story, and you don't really see that much, but the build-up of the tension and the build-up of the whole sex scene actually starts when Ross leaves the house and Demelza's side. You know, that's the build-up of the scene. She's not even in it. The whole conversation, the whole tension, all of that, that is all the sex scene, because we all kind of feel, we understand what's happening. So you can do it in that way as well. You don't need to show anything if you don't feel comfortable writing it. And actually, to be honest, if you don't feel comfortable writing it, then you shouldn't be writing it, because otherwise it's gonna read. Your readers will feel it.
Or it should be written, you know, privately for your own personal, you know, development as a writer, rather than if you're writing it and you're thinking, oh my god, someone's going to read it, then you might actually be uncomfortable as you're doing it, as you say. Talking about things like emotional exposure, that's the bit I have trouble with. It's not the actual physicality of any of it, it's the emotional exposure. So I remember when I first got the first lot of edits back for I Belong to the Earth, and whenever there was a kissing scene, and there aren't that many in all fairness, whenever I got one, my editor had made a little note saying this could use more, and I was just like, oh, I don't want to write anymore, this is so horribly embarrassing. I can feel myself going red just looking at it, and I still suffer a little bit from that now, but I don't think it's so obvious that I feel awkward about it, hopefully.
It's good that you don't, because things are getting a little bit more racy now.
Maybe a little bit, yeah. You don't know, I might slam the doors on you yet. But no, it is the emotional exposure side of it, because I've written sex scenes for books before and it's just a case of not bothered, but it's what you're depicting, and in lots of those other scenes it's a case of the character feeling betrayed, let down in some way or something. It's been a negative emotion and I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But the actual proper emotional exposure of two characters properly connecting, I'm just like, oh god, can't write this. Knuckles in mouth kind of thing. So yeah, that's my confession. That's something I'm working on. So Madeline, how about you?
Okay. Well, I've definitely written sex scenes.
Yes.
I have definitely written some very steamy sex scenes in my time. And I think, I think I started it just to practice, actually, in many ways. It was about practicing it, because I wasn't comfortable doing it to start. I was very sort of, oh, tee-hee. I'm doing something naughty, before having to remind myself that literally most of the people around me had had sex, because, you know, they were adults and most of them are children, so logically. So I have definitely written sex scenes. And there is a sex scene that... There is a sex scene in the third book of the Hamashi cycle, which I will have to rewrite because it was written a long time ago. And there is technically a sex scene in the second book as well, which you don't see on screen, as it were.
Yeah.
You see the aftermath of it. So I guess I should ask you, Jules, did you feel that the tension and stuff like that worked?
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, as we've said before, the whole point is to advance the plot or the character arc, and it does do both of those things.
That's good to know. I think a lot of people are going to be very unhappy with me when it comes to that scene. I've also edited it, so I'm going to send you the new version. I think it's going to upset you even more.
Oh, fabulous, because it didn't upset me enough the first time.
There is also another scene, which is... It's a violent scene, which kind of has a sexual undertone. Do you know the one I mean?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's the one near the end. It's with Zachary and another character, and Zachary's basically getting beaten up. And there is a sexual... and I kind of wrote it with a sort of a sexual undertone because, yeah, it was about... love and violence, and it was about repressed love, I think, in many ways, and repressed desire and that sort of coming out in a way. So again, that was a sex scene which didn't actually involve any kind of sex. It was a lot more about fear and anger. But one thing is that, and I kind of appreciate it, what your position is like, because obviously you write in first person. The first person is a lot more personal, and I've read a few sex scenes in the Dresden Files, and often you get urban fantasy where they do have, you know, quite sort of steamy sort of sex scenes. And obviously Kestrel Saga is also an urban fantasy. It's in the first person as well, and Kestrel is 24 at the start of the series, and she's gonna have sex, and it's probably gonna be quite awkward for me to write it, because so much of Kestrel is based off of me, and I'll know the people are reading it. So I think I'm gonna have to address how I look at sex from the first person perspective, because it will be different, obviously, from when I write it in The Sons of Thestian, because The Sons of Thestian, because of its backdrop, because of it being set in another world and all the context and things like that, the sex is almost separated a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas the sex in an urban fantasy series, which is set in the modern day, it's in the first person, it's a lot more personal in many ways. And I think when you get, and you know, listening to some of the examples that you just read, when you get first person sex scenes, there's even more potential for things to go disastrously wrong in your writing.
Yeah, I think potentially, and a lot of it is probably that sort of shying at the first fence kind of thing. It's just like, oh, hang on a minute, I'm writing this as I, and can I do a separation of church and state as to me and characters?
Yeah,
because obviously if you write in first person, you're not necessarily writing about yourself, you're writing about that character. But
of course not. But
then you have this moment of the fear where you think, yes, my dad's going to read this. And
yeah, I got over that fear a little bit because I wrote this horrific, and I mean utterly horrific, rape scene in a story once, and forgot that it was in there because the story was very, very long. And I let my dad read it, and he never spoke to me about it, but... I don't know. I honestly don't know. So he read that, and so I think after that, I think he's just nullified. I think he's just cold to everything else that I can possibly throw at him.
See, I mean, when I started, this is, it's not really sex, but obviously when I started karate, when I was 15. I might have been a bit younger, but anyway, there was I'd been doing it for a little while, and Dad and I used to watch martial art films together, and there was a bit where I can't even remember which actor it was, but in my opinion, it's like, it would have been better if he'd just broken the guy's neck on the floor, But he doesn't. He lets him get up. And I said, oh, for goodness sake, you should have broken his neck. And my dad said, Jules, in his really horrified voice. His teenage daughter just said, no, he attacked you, murder him. And it's like, I imagine that, see, I don't understand how my sister did this. She actually sat and watched Basic Instinct with my dad. How did you do that kind of thing? I'm in awe.
Okay, well, I think I can actually one-up you on that one. Okay, this is a little bit of a funny story before we, because I think we're going to have to finish soon, aren't we?
Oh, we are, yeah.
Yeah. For anyone who travels frequently and who's ever been to the kind of the Middle East, we used to live in the Middle East, so we would watch a lot of films on the plane as we were, you know, going between the UK, where I was at school, and sort of heading home. And my mum watched Love Actually on a flight to Dubai. And of course, what they do on the planes, especially in Middle Eastern countries, is they cut out the sex scenes, cut out all of the racy scenes. They're just cut out. So Love Actually, as you know, there's the little side story with the two porn stars. Yeah. But that was all cut out. And because there were so many characters, my mum didn't really notice that those two, you know, didn't notice the lack of those scenes. So fast forward to pre-Christmas. Mum says, we've got my grandparents staying. Mum says, let's watch Love Actually. It's such a lovely film. And my brother and I were like, Mum, are you sure? And she was still like, oh, yeah, it'd be perfectly fine. So she puts it on. And we get to the first sex scene. And there's my grandparents, my very, you know, my grandmother, who was Baptist, raised Baptist. And they're watching it. And Mum wants to die. So she goes, oh, crap. Okay, we've got to get through these scenes. So she pressed fast forward, which means you lose all of the innocent dialogue.
Yeah, but you see everything.
You see everything, yeah. And it's just so much worse if it's sped up. So that was the traumatizing time that I sat and watched Love Actually with my grandparents.
I think that's an interesting point, though, because there's obviously... Everyone who writes, there's someone out there you think, oh my god, if they ever read it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Unless you're really, really clean, and it's impossible to do that and still be really honest.
Well, let's just say I'm actually rather glad that half of my family on the other side are all French, and I don't write in French, and they can't read my books in English. My grandmother's just like, oh yeah, I'd love to read your stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love for you to read it too. Oh god, thank god. Oh thank god.
But I mean, does that mean that you would turn down sort of French language rights?
No, I wouldn't. I think some people in that side of the family might ostracize me forever. No, don't come here and don't come near my children ever again, you dirty heathen. But no, I wouldn't. But I think that... there's always going to be someone, as we're writing this sex scene, where we think I really, really don't want them to read this. And that reminds me actually of Hamish Steele, who wrote Pantheon. And of course there is a page in Pantheon which is fairly explicit, and it's just him mentioning the fact that of course he knew his mother and family were going to read it. And I love it because we all just go say, oh, and you know, and then we get to that page and we all know which page he's talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I did meet Adele Parks a couple of years ago, and she writes sort of women's fiction, which, you know, I don't read an awful lot of. But she did say, look, you have to go with the attitude of you just don't think about anybody that you know reading what you write, basically, because she said you'd just be paralysed. And she said you just need to write what you want to, and... whatever anyone else thinks, it's none of your business ultimately what they think of it.
Well, I think quite often, actually, you know, if we think of us, we get too worried about it. Very often, people who are reading things don't really apply the fact that you wrote it until sort of later, if that makes sense.
No,
I think as they're reading it, they're not thinking, oh, this person wrote this.
Yeah,
they're reading it, and then
I think if you wrote like dinosaur erotica or something like that, then that might.
Yeah,
you know, draw them up short. I mean, I keep getting sent books to review that are supposed to be epic fantasy and actually turn out to be tentacle porn, which doesn't please me greatly because that's really not my sort of thing. But
no, that's such a which doesn't please me greatly.
Well, no, it doesn't. It's just like, I think, oh, I'm getting epic fantasy, and like 30 pages in, I've invested that amount of time, and there are tentacles everywhere, and there's weird sort of lactation stuff going on, and it's just like, ugh, gotta stop now.
Good, well, I'm glad that happened.
It's like, well, thank you for that.
So, yes, sex is something that is inevitable in fiction, as it is inevitable in life. But there are ways of making sure that if you choose to write sex, you don't do it in a way that's going to make you become an internet meme.
Yeah, it's not actually as hard as you think it is. You don't have to include actual sex, for example.
Nope.
And if you have to apply metaphor, as Madeline says, do it around the emotional content rather than the physical act. Don't go into all the detail too much on the physical act unless you do want it to sound like plumbing.
And avoid livestock.
Avoid livestock. I think, you know, what all those literary examples have pointed out are avoid livestock.
Avoid livestock and certain foods. There are certain foods which can have a sexy kind of connotation to them. Cottage cheese is not one of them.
So
I'm just an example. So yes. And on that note, we hope that you have a very sexy evening. And we'll catch up with you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.